During this COVID-19 pandemic, many patients and healthcare providers have turned to telehealth services. One of the first genetic counseling companies in this space was Advanced Telegenetic Counseling in 2016. ATGC was conceptualized and grown by genetic counselors so that patients like you could access a genetic counselor no matter where you live. Their services are more important than ever to reduce your exposure during this pandemic. Learn more and book your appointment today with a board-certified genetic counselor at at-gc.com. Again, that's at-gc.com.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, we explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics, experts like genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. This episode is part of our ongoing direct consumer genetic testing series. My guest today is Melanie Hardy, Assistant Director of J-Screen Genetic Counseling Services, which is part of Emory University School of Medicine. Melanie has been an active member in the National Society of Genetic Counselors and the American Board of Genetic Counseling, including chairing multiple committees, work groups, and programs. She has also served on capstone committees for genetic counseling students at multiple universities. Thank you, Melanie, for coming on this show. We're going to be talking about carrier testing today, so thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
And I thought we'd start our conversation with talking about Ashkenazi Jewish people and that are coming from that descent, since you're the assistant director of J-Screen Genetic Counseling Service. Why is it more common for people of Ashkenazi Jewish descent to be carriers of genetic conditions when we compare them to the general population or just another person that maybe we'd randomly pull off the street?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, it's really important for everyone to know that any person from any population is prone to carrying several different genetic conditions. So being a carrier is common across the board. But specific to the Ashkenazi Jewish population, there have been a number of founder effects in their history. And so a founder effect happens when a small portion of a population sort of breaks off, moves to a new area, and begins a new population in that new area. And that small population takes with them their genetics. So if that small group happened to be carriers of a handful of conditions, then those conditions sort of spread throughout the new area, the new population that forms. And we've seen several founder effects in the history of the Ashkenazi Jewish population, and that has led to this increased number of conditions that they may carry.
And for those that may not be familiar, what does it mean when someone is a carrier of a condition?
Yeah, so when we talk about carriers, we kind of have to think about how our genetic material works. So we get half of our genetic material from our mom, half from our dad. So we really have two copies of each gene in our genome. And when somebody's a carrier, it means one of those two copies has a mutation or a variation, a variant, and it causes that gene to not work properly. The other copy of the gene still works just fine, and that's generally enough to keep the person healthy. So they wouldn't really know that they are a carrier of this variant until either we test them or they and their partner happen to carry the same variant in the same gene and then have a child affected.
And so with carrier screening, you're identifying if someone is a carrier of certain conditions. How many conditions are typically tested on carrier screening? I mean, this really varies depending on what company. I don't know if you can mention kind of what the range is and what J-Screen looks at.
Yeah, there is huge variability in what this looks like from one option to the next. Historically, a lot of people have gotten this kind of testing with their OB office, for example, or with their general practitioner. And sometimes the panels that those providers offer may be as few as 1 to 3 diseases. So they can be exceptionally small. A lot of the carrier testing companies have moved into something called expanded carrier screening, where they're really looking at a wide variety of different conditions. So for example, J-Screen tests for 226 conditions on our panel right now. These different panels can range from less than 100 to hundreds of conditions. And there are, plans to develop panels that may involve over 1,000. So they can be exceptionally variable in what they look like.
And another aspect of carrier testing that's going to differ between companies is the way that the testing works. So what exactly they're looking at, if they're looking at more of a simple aspect or more complete, how does that look like in the lab? What is the difference between those two?
Yeah, this is such a great question and something that I really hope that people think a lot about before they pursue carrier screening. It's not just how many conditions are on the panel. Another really important aspect is how the carrier screening lab is doing the testing. So some labs do something called genotyping, where they're just looking for certain mutations in the gene, sort of known hotspots that are prone to carrying variations, but they don't look at other parts of the gene. So with genotyping, your detection rates tend to be a little bit lower, and there's a chance there that they might miss significant portions of the gene where those variants could be hiding. What a lot of carrier screening companies have moved into is something called DNA sequencing. Sequencing is sort of like scanning along a gene, looking for the changes that may be present. And a lot of carrier testing companies have added on something called copy number analysis. This is just another layer of depth in the ability to view a gene and any variants that may lurk there. So when you see sequencing, you often see higher detection rates. The average consumer is not necessarily going to read through the fine print and figure out if some lab is using genotyping or sequencing, but what they can look at are the detection rates. If you see detection rates that are like 10%, that's really a pretty poor coverage of that gene. For example, on the J-Screen test, most of the conditions on our panel have a detection rate closer to 99%. And there's no such thing as 100%. So 99% is very, very good.
Yeah, it's very high. And it is important to see, okay, you're getting this carrier screening, but what exactly does that mean? What are they looking at? And I thank you for giving such a good description of, genotyping versus the sequencing and the new area with the copy number variances seems to be coming on the scene much more recently. And we mentioned earlier, like how what it means to be a carrier, and talking about that autosomal recessive inheritance, where we have two copies of every gene, and as long as one is working, it's usually good enough to keep us healthy and not have symptoms if we're a carrier and one of those genes doesn't work. But as in genetics, there's always some exceptions. What are conditions where, as we're doing more research, we're finding that carriers may have some symptoms, and previously we may have thought, you're a carrier, no symptoms, but what conditions are we starting to question this a little bit more?
Yeah, this is a really important question, I think, for people to understand, is that number one, human genetics is not for the faint of heart. We are very, very complex creatures. We don't have all the answers yet, but we are continually learning more and more about these diseases. We do know about several that where carriers do have the potential to show some symptoms themselves. So for example, one of them is something called factor 11 deficiency. This is a very mild form of hemophilia. And what we find is that a certain portion of people who carry this condition are prone to nosebleeds, easy bruising, heavy menstruation. And so they're not symptoms that are generally impacting of everyday life, but they can be kind of a nuisance. So sometimes we see that. There's another condition we test and frequently find carriers of, something called pseudocolinesterase deficiency. This is a condition where carriers, as well as people who are affected by it, they can have a reaction to anesthesia, where instead of the body breaking down anesthesia within a few minutes, where the numbness caused by the anesthesia wears off, in these individuals, it can take from 5 minutes up to a few hours. So it's not really an adverse effect, but there is the potential that they just may need a little extra attention if they use a particular form of anesthesia. Those are kind of some of the simple and straightforward ones. We find those, the carriers of those conditions, pretty frequently. They're actually quite common. There are other ones that we're discovering more about. So, for example, familial Mediterranean fever. There are a lot of reports that some people who seem to have symptoms of the condition appear to be just carriers. So they just have one copy of a gene that's not working properly, as opposed to two copies. It looks like a lot of carriers of this condition do not have symptoms, but some of them potentially do. The good news is that FMF does have treatment, so we can help those individuals who are symptomatic. Then there are some that are a little less common. So there are certain conditions like ataxia telangiectasia or Nijmegen breakage syndrome. These are not super common conditions for sure, but we do know that people who carry these conditions may have a slightly higher risk for developing certain types of cancer. So their cancer screening may need to be increased above that of the general population. So whenever we find carriers who may have symptoms of conditions, we look at, we talk a lot about what are the symptoms that they may experience and what are the potential treatments or ways that we can deal with those symptoms.
And for the cancer risk, there's also the concept that carriers of a, now you have to correct me on, I'm trying to think of which one it is, one of the BRCA genes, if they are, if their partner is also a carrier, there's a risk of the child having Fanconi anemia. Now, is this included in some carrier screen, or it's too revealing of the own person's carrier, cancer risk?
Right. Yeah. So when we look at carrier screening panels, generally the rule is we're trying to look for conditions that could impact the children or the reproductive risk of the people that we test. We're not trying to test for personal health risk. So that's one of the reasons why we do not include BRCA1 or 2, those genes associated with breast cancer risk, on our panels.
And so if someone knows that they are a BRCA carrier, that may be a conversation then with a genetic counselor if their partner were to get tested, but they'd have to know that ahead of time.
Right. Yeah, I would absolutely recommend a conversation with a genetic counselor to figure out if there is a risk there, and what kinds of risks are present, not only for the person, but their kids.
Certainly. And there's a lot for consumers or patients. There's so many different words we can use for people that are using genetic tests now, depending on what type of test they're ordering. There are a lot of things to consider before purchasing these tests and going through the process. What are other limitations of the test that consumers and patients should be aware of before going into this?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things is that, you know, the test panel can only tell you about the conditions that are on the panel. So that's one of the reasons why looking at the conditions that are present and how many of them are there is one important consideration. Labs are always working to improve these panels to, you know, increase the number of conditions, increase the detection rate. But everyone should realize that there is no such thing as a perfect genetic test. No test will give you a 100% guarantee that you wouldn't, that you would have or that you wouldn't have a child affected. So, having the high detection rates can be helpful, but even with that, no test is perfect.
And that brings up a good point of, if someone had carrier testing years ago, is this relevant and accurate for their entire reproductive years? Or does it get to a point where genetic counselors may say, maybe you should repeat some of this testing, it's been X amount of years?
So the genetics of the person aren't expected to change. We don't expect that the person's going to suddenly become a carrier of something that they weren't before. The difference over time is that the testing changes. So if a person had testing, you know, even 5-10 years ago, that maybe doesn't feel like so long ago, but the testing has improved exponentially since then. So the number of conditions, our capability of finding things is way higher than what it was way back when. So we encourage anybody who comes through JScreen to touch base with us about 3 to 6 months prior to a pregnancy with their partner, just because we want to tell them if we have any updates available to our testing so they could think about whether they want to upgrade their testing or not.
And with this testing, are variants of uncertain significance or variants that we don't really understand the clinical significance of them, are they included in reports, or is it only reporting pathogenic variants or variants that we're sure this means the gene won't work?
Yeah, we only report pathogenic variants. So we want sort of concrete information for couples to be able to use for reproductive planning. If we found that there was a variant of uncertain significance in the family, so some other member of the family was a carrier of something, we can ask the lab to provide that information for us. But generally speaking, we don't reveal that information.
Which makes sense, because if you're testing hundreds of genes, I can't imagine how many variants are coming up. You're going to spend your entire day just talking about variants.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about, you know, hundreds of conditions that are being screened for carrier screening, how many of these have an overlap with newborn screening, where most babies have newborn screening? It's usually an opt-out process. So unless you opt out of it when a baby's born, they're going to have their newborn screening. So how many of these conditions are they going to end up being screened for at birth?
Yeah. So newborn screening actually varies quite significantly from one state or territory to the next. Generally speaking, most of them have between 30 and 60 different conditions on their newborn screen. So there's, you know, a good portion of diseases that they're screening for. But and the majority of those are going to be found on carrier screening panels like those of JScreen, the more robust panels that you'll find out there. The big difference, and one of the reasons why I always caution people not to solely rely on newborn screening, is number one, the conditions on the newborn screen are put there specifically because we need to test for those early, because early treatment can either help to reduce or even eliminate the chance for symptoms in a child who's affected. There is the potential on newborn screening for a carrier to get flagged as a positive. And so that means if the child is not actually affected by the disease, but is just a carrier, the parents may get a really scary call that says, we think your child may have this condition. They need to do extra genetic testing to confirm that result. But in the meantime, that waiting period is a really, really high anxiety time period. The other thing is that because these diseases are specifically put on newborn screening panels to be treated early, what they're not including is those conditions where there maybe isn't a treatment or have a different course as far as symptoms and severity in the child. That's where carrier screening really kind of takes up the slack and tests for those conditions that a couple would potentially really want to know about before they become pregnant, but they don't necessarily have a treatment for after the child is born.
And if a person or a couple is identified as being a carrier for a condition, what would they talk about during a genetic counseling session about their results, and like what would be some of the next steps that were discussed and options that they had?
Yeah, so in a genetic counseling session, we just go over the results of the testing. We reveal what was found. We help people understand the conditions that were present and the symptoms that are associated with that condition. We also talk about reproductive risk. So if we're talking to an individual who is a carrier, then we can discuss the chance that their partner might be a carrier based on the carrier rate in the general population. So we can give them some numbers to help them understand how common the condition is. If two people are found to both be a carrier of the same thing, we can have a joint discussion with the two of them and then talk about reproductive options. And those options will vary significantly depending on the condition we're talking about. So, there are really a range of different things that we can discuss with people, but they might include IVF, in vitro fertilization, with PGT, pre-implantation genetic testing. And the simple overview, really simplified overview of this, is that we combine sperm and egg, grow embryos, test those embryos for the condition, and only implant those that do not have the condition. There's also use of an egg or a sperm donor who was tested and doesn't carry the condition. There are options for testing during a pregnancy. So if a couple is already pregnant, there are ways that we can test to see if the baby might be affected by the condition. We talk to people about the option of adoption. And then depending on the severity of the condition, sometimes just getting pregnant naturally and testing the child, treating the child for the condition after birth may be an option.
And for them, if they were naturally conceiving, they're taking that chance. If we're talking about one of those autosomal recessive conditions that we've referred to, they would have a 25% chance. So there's 75% chance that they would conceive a pregnancy that was not affected. So there's also that angle. And you mentioned IVF there as well. If people want to learn more about that, we had 7 episodes about genetics and fertility. So definitely go back and listen to those episodes. Going along a little bit with that IVF, I don't really know too much about how much donors are screened and maybe how this has changed. Do you know at all if there are standards in the field that donors have to be doing carrier testing a certain amount, or maybe that doesn't even exist yet?
Yeah, I don't know if there are specific standards that have to be followed in the IVF world, but I can tell you from working with a lot of couples who are undergoing IVF, sort of following J-screen testing, that when they ask us questions about whether this donor or that donor would be compatible given their genetic results from J-screen, what we see as far as the testing in the donor varies widely from one IVF center to another. I think some of them have the philosophy that if we don't test as much, then this donor is more likely to be chosen because it sort of appears that they don't carry very much stuff. Other centers have kind of adopted a different philosophy and realized that the more stuff we can test a donor for, the more that we can sort of ensure that we're not potentially putting together egg and sperm that would lead to having a child affected with something that we weren't aware of.
And I've seen in one of my rotations back as a student that there was a couple who were identified. One of them that was going to be the biological mother was identified as having being a carrier for a condition, and the donor ended up going through genetic carrier screening to see if he was also. So at that point, they had already selected the donor, but then kind of went back and did extra screening. I don't know if that was kind of an N number of one or how often that happens, but it's definitely something that seems to be really changing in the field, along with so much infertility. It just, everything is happening so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen similar scenarios where sometimes they are able to go back and ask a donor to do additional screening, specifically because the other individual, the person who's requesting sort of being matched up with a donor has tested positive for something that the donor hadn't been tested for previously. So sometimes it is possible to get additional screening. Sometimes it's not.
Definitely depends on the person. I'm sure as time goes on, it will become more standard because more and more people are getting carrier screening and at earlier ages and more preconception as time goes on. So it'll be interesting to follow to see how that changes in the field. And I did want to ask probably one of the most frequently questions I think genetic counselors get among all the different specialties. Most genetic tests can use saliva or blood sample. Is there a difference in accuracy between the two samples?
Yeah, we don't expect there to be any difference in the accuracy of the results. The big difference between saliva and blood is if you had an equal volume of saliva versus blood, there are a lot more cells in the blood sample than in the saliva sample. And it's the cells that the lab has to spin down, extract the DNA from, and then that starts the testing process. So if you have a smaller amount of material to start with, sometimes you can't get all the way through the testing process and meet all of your quality assurance checks. So that's one of the most important things to know about these clinical labs that do this testing, is that they have hundreds of these quality assurance checks. And if a sample doesn't meet all of them, you don't get a result. So the lab is not going to put out results that they don't have confidence in. So if a saliva sample didn't contain enough DNA or was of lower quality DNA, we're probably going to get a message from the lab if the sample isn't sufficient to complete the testing process, that the person needs to complete a recollection. So that's the big difference, is that with a saliva sample, there's a little higher chance that we're going to need a recollection than with a blood sample.
Well, thank you so much for exploring so much topics within carrier testing. We hit newborn screening, VUSs, donors. So I think we were able to really touch on a lot of areas. Appreciate you sharing your expertise with this. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Learn more by going to jscreen.org. And if you're interested in learning more about the show and looking at over 130 episodes of the show, you can go to dnapodcast.com. We're also super active on social media. So search DNA Today on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, you name it, we're on it. So please connect with us. It is great to interact with you there. And if you have any questions for myself, Melanie, or any of the other guests that have been on DNA Today over the last 130 or so episodes, you can email in info@dnapodcast.com. Also, the website has a contact form if that's easier for you to use. And loyal listeners will know what comes next. Please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this podcast, and you can give it a little love and support. We would really appreciate it. It has helped the show grow so much over the past 8 years. So thank you so much. Before we wrap up, I wanted to remind you about Advanced Telegenetic Counseling's telehealth services. ATGC allows for you to meet with a genetic counselor from the comfort and safety of your home during this pandemic. As loyal listeners of the show know, ATGC provides genetic counseling services for fertility, as we mentioned in our fertility series earlier this year. ATGC services also expand to other areas like ophthalmology, pharmacogenomics, cardiology, neurology, cancer, and carrier screening, which you're now familiar with. The most common question I get about genetic counseling is, what do you talk about in a genetic counseling session? A few major areas that an ATGC genetic counselor will discuss are personal and family health history, the benefits and limitations for genetic testing options, and your specific genetic risk factors. If you're a healthcare provider, you can also refer your patients to speak with one of these board-certified genetic counselors at ATGC. Not every institution has a genetic counselor, and many that do have a long waiting list, so avoid those waits by going to at-gc.com to book your appointment or refer a patient. Again, that's at-gc.com. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.